Four women sit at separate desks across Europe and America in 1943. One starves herself in a London hospital bed, writing feverishly about grace. Another dynamites buildings on paper in New York, celebrating the sovereignty of genius. A third teaches Hegel to students in Nazi-occupied Paris, quietly building a philosophy of mutual liberation. The fourth researches the anatomy of totalitarianism in Manhattan, documenting how systems turn humans into things. They've never met as a group, yet they're engaged in the same urgent work, redefining what it means to be human when the world seems determined to erase that meaning entirely. Hannah Arendt, Simone de Beauvoir, Ayn Rand, and Simone Weil didn't choose philosophy as a career path. Philosophy chose them, forced upon them by exile, occupation, and the collapse of civilization itself. Picture Germany in 1933. Engineers rent chairs in public gardens. Elderly men in bowler hats beg at subway exits. Nearly half the working class sits idle while political factions tear each other apart instead of confronting the rising Nazi threat. For Hannah Arendt, the breaking point came during breakfast near Berlin's Alexanderplatz when the Gestapo arrested her and her mother. Though released the same day, Arendt understood. There was no future here, at least not for people like her. She escaped through a house with a front door in Germany and a back door in Czechoslovakia, what refugees called the classic route. By summer, 40,000 had fled, 20,000 reaching Paris. Simone Weil witnessed France's collapse as a laboratory for testing her theories about oppression. The Red Simone wrapped herself in red flags, led protest marches singing the International, and donated most of her teaching salary to refugees while keeping only what unemployed workers received. Yet behind this fierce revolutionary lived another Simone, fragile, ascetic, plagued by headaches so severe they drove her to contemplate suicide. Across the Atlantic, Ayn Rand faced her own crisis. The Great Depression had drained her finances, her husband's acting career stalled, and publishers rejected her novels during an era when Roosevelt's New Deal made collectivist solutions fashionable. In her diary, she wrote, "You are only a writing engine, all will and all control." She was building a philosophy of radical individualism that would either transform American culture or sink without a trace. By late 1934, Rand's courtroom drama, Woman on Trial, premiered with an innovative twist. 12 audience volunteers served as jury, delivering a real verdict. Critics praised the play, but Rand was disappointed they missed its true subject, the struggle between heroic individuals and the masses. In early 1933, at the Bec de Gaz bar in Paris, Raymond Aron introduced Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir to phenomenology. "If you are a phenomenologist, you can talk about this cocktail and make philosophy out of it." This was what Sartre had sought, a way to describe objects exactly as he saw them, extracting philosophy from the process itself. Edmund Husserl's principle, back to things themselves, meant describing what appears to consciousness without distortion. His key insight, consciousness is always consciousness of something. While Beauvoir and Sartre discovered phenomenology, Weil was writing her Intellectual Will and Testament, reflections concerning the causes of liberty and social oppression. Their first meeting sparked immediate conflict. Beauvoir envied Weil's capacity to weep over famine in China, having a heart that could beat right across the world. But when Weil declared revolution to feed the starving was all that mattered, Beauvoir countered that finding meaning in existence was more important. Weil's cutting response, "It's easy to see you've never been hungry," ended their relationship instantly. This tension between individual meaning and collective suffering would define their divergent paths. In December 1934, Simone Weil took an unskilled factory job to test her political theories, crossing a class divide that Marx, Engels, Trotsky, and Stalin never had. Her diary captured dizzying production speeds, relentless fatigue, and overwhelming slavery. She never met quotas. The monotony bred accident-prone absent-mindedness and inner death. Fear invaded her dreams, murderous headaches persisted. This experience sharpened her critique. Could humans maintain dignity under such conditions? She challenged Marx's faith that productive progress brings liberation, arguing capitalism and communism shared a dangerous growth fetish. Meanwhile, in Rouen, a charged drama unfolded between Beauvoir, Sartre, and Olga, an 18-year-old former pupil. This romantic triangle embodied philosophical tensions between freedom and necessity. Unlike Beauvoir, who fought consciously for emancipation, Olga threw herself into life without plans, living entirely in the present. What troubled Beauvoir wasn't sexual jealousy, but Olga's challenge to her bond with Sartre. Was their relationship truly necessary? Could freedom exist within commitment? These weren't abstract questions. They were lived dilemmas shaping Beauvoir's emerging philosophy. By 1936, Europe hurtled toward war as Hitler invaded the Rhineland, Mussolini proclaimed empire, and Stalin executed opponents. Against this backdrop, the four philosophers grappled with love, freedom, and commitment. Hannah Arendt fell for Heinrich Blücher, a Berlin-born autodidact living illegally in Paris. The impoverished former communist was a pariah par excellence, entirely to Arendt's taste. Through her doctoral thesis on Augustine, she discovered how Christian philosophy diminished the individual other, directing true love toward God rather than unique persons. By 1936, she recognized Augustine's theological devaluation had found secular expression in totalitarianism, where the almighty Führer replaced God. For Arendt, private love became resistance against total conformity, a revolutionary discovery where she could achieve both the love of her life and oneness with herself. Meanwhile, Beauvoir and Sartre lived a hotel room existence, making cafes their studies. In August 1936, Simone Weil joined Republican forces in Spain despite extreme short-sightedness. Her comrades voted against issuing her a rifle. Her participation ended when she stepped into boiling oil, causing severe burns that likely saved her life, as most of her unit was later executed. The experience deepened her critique of violence. She observed that slaughter required a fundamental blockage of the human imagination about who belonged to humanity. Once certain people are placed outside those whose life has value, nothing comes more naturally than murder. By late 1938, Weil's deteriorating health made teaching impossible. Her persistent headaches mirrored the worsening political situation, leading her to contemplate suicide. Unable to work intellectually, she sought relief through sacred music. At the Benedictine Abbey of Solems, she attended every service despite intense headaches, where each sound was as painful as a blow. Through extreme concentration, she found a pure and perfect joy in the ineffable beauty of the song, an experience revealing the possibility of loving divine love through misfortune. Reciting George Herbert's poem, Love, during intense headaches, Weil felt Christ's immediate presence, a mystical experience convincing her she had encountered transcendence beyond human language. When France fell to Nazi Germany in June 1940, Simone de Beauvoir suffered her first nervous breakdown. She joined the mass flight of over 3 million Parisians, packing only necessities, including her decade of correspondence with Sartre. Under Marshal Petain's armistice, she felt like a character in some futuristic novel where time had gone haywire. Hannah Arendt escaped from the women's camp at Gurs, eventually encountering Walter Benjamin. When France agreed to surrender former German citizens to the Nazis, Arendt grasped the Nazi program's true horror, not merely persecution, but the systematic preparation of living corpses, extinguishing all spontaneity to transform individuals into predictable things. During the phony war, Simone Weil produced The Iliad, or The Poem of Force, identifying how violence turns humans into objects, first by killing them, but more insidiously by transforming living people into things with souls. Force destroys both victims and perpetrators. Force is as pitiless to the man who possesses it as it is to its victims. To combat fear, Beauvoir imposed strict routines, studying Hegel's phenomenology at the Bibliothèque Nationale. A year after Paris fell, rigidity gave way to resolve. In January 1941, she created a new philosophy of freedom based on mutual existential recognition. Freedom could only be won together. Human reality is nothing other than what it makes itself be. Meanwhile, Ayn Rand was developing her own vision. By February 1936, she had fully conceptualized Howard Roark, an architect embodying radical individualism whose complete selfishness is as natural to him as breathing. In March 1938, Rand crafted her novel's climactic plot. Roark would destroy a public housing project built from his designs after a committee compromised his vision. By 1943, the four philosophers had crystallized their visions. Ayn Rand's, the Fountainhead, proclaimed through Howard Roark, "I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life." Simone de Beauvoir, suspended from teaching, published her first novel, arguing one must promote others' freedom for one's own. Hannah Arendt researched totalitarianism's roots in New York, becoming very much her own woman. Simone Weil, hospitalized and refusing food in solidarity with starving French citizens, called Ashford Sanatorium a beautiful room to die in. When asked her profession, she smiled, "A philosopher interested in humanity." These visionaries responded to catastrophe by developing frameworks that still shape our understanding of freedom and dignity. Their divergent paths, Weil's mystical Christianity, Rand's radical individualism, Beauvoir's existential feminism, Arendt's political theory, offer complementary answers to one question: what makes life meaningful when overwhelming forces threaten to crush the individual spirit? Their answers, forged in exile and war, remain vital for navigating uncertain times. Philosophy isn't academic exercise, but necessary response to existence's pressing questions. In a world still struggling with authoritarianism and inequality, their voices echo urgently. Think for yourself, love fiercely, resist conformity, create meaning. Your freedom depends on it.